History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The years leading up to World War II saw major espionage operations going on by all major nations involved. Russia had spies embedded at the highest levels of Nazi Germany. For example, the German journalist Richard Sorge, who is in Japan, was good friends with German diplomats in Tokyo and was able to warn Russia about Operation Barbarossa. George Koval was born in America, but he agreed to spy also on behalf of the Soviet Union and was deeply embedded in the Manhattan Project. But did you know that there were a number of Nazi spies in the United States in the mid-1930s? Just as the United States was embarking on a policy of neutrality, Nazi Germany embarked on a program of espionage against the nation. Today's guest is Emeritus Professor Rody Jeffy Drones, and he's the author of the book The Nazi Spy Ring in America, Hitler's Agents, the FBI, and the Case That Stirred the Nation. We're going to look at Hitler's attempts to interfere in American affairs by spreading anti-Semitic propaganda, stealing military technology, and mapping U.S. defenses. Germany's Foreign Intelligence Service, the Abwehr, was able to steal top-secret U.S. technology, such as a prototype code-breaking machine, and data about the latest fighter planes. Enlisting the services of German-American fascists and anti-Semites, they resorted to really ruthless methods to achieve their goals, including murdering the wife and daughter of an American industrialist. When the spy ring was busted in 1938 by FBI agent Leon Trureau, the ensuing trial caused a national sensation and played a significant role in shifting public opinion against Germany, awakening many Americans to the looming Nazi threat. So in this episode, we're going to be looking into the role of espionage in shaping American perceptions of Germany in the years leading up to U.S. entry into World War II. It's a now-forgotten but significant episode in the history of international relations, and I hope you enjoyed this episode with Rody Jeffy Drones. Professor Jeffy Drones, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Well, I am very interested in this topic, and I've looked at spycraft and espionage on this series in World War II from many different angles, but never from the perspective of Nazi spies within the United States during World War II or before World War II. What originally piqued your interest in this topic, whether as an academic historian or from a more popular perspective?
Well, I live in Scotland, and in Scotland there was a woman called Jessie Jordan. Now, she spied for Germany in 1937 to 1939, but she also served a secondary function. She was a letterbox, as they call it. So in order to throw the intelligence services off the tracks in the UK and the USA, they would post letters from the United States to Hamburg via her address in Dundee. So the letter would arrive there and she would readdress it to Germany. Now, MI5 had got onto this and they were intercepting her mail. And when a letter arrived from the United States implicating American spies, they decided to tip off the FBI. Now, I'd written an article about Jessie Jordan, but when I saw this FBI angle, I wrote off to the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act and asked if they could make available some of the documentation. This was about 7 or 8 years ago, and there was a chap there in the FBI called John Russo, who went to huge trouble to send me tens of thousands of documents relating to this case, and I could see straight away that there was a good story here and that made an interesting book.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What was the reason that Nazi Germany conducted foreign espionage in the United States? Other players at this time, such as Russia, wanted to learn military intelligence, like the spy Richard Sorge. Others wanted to learn atomic secrets. So the Russian spy George Koval infiltrated the Manhattan Project. What was their reason for wanting to spy in the United States?
Well, there are quite strong similarities between the German efforts and the Soviet efforts. They had placed agents, that is, the Soviet Union had placed agents, for example, in MIT. And in the period that I'm looking at, which relates to Germany, the Soviet Union were doing exactly the same thing. They were out for technical data. And the FBI has come in for a great deal of criticism, because while it was ardently anti-communist and came down hard on American communists, it didn't manage to find out about the Soviet espionage against the United States. So there was a parallel German effort for very similar reasons. Now, Hitler, who came to power in 1933, was a great admirer of Henry Ford, and he wanted American technical details, including military secrets, so that he could rebuild the German army and navy, and following the demobilization of post-World War I, which had been forced on Germany by the victors in that conflict. So the advent of Hitler in 1933 was a turning point. And then in 1935, he appointed Wilhelm Canaris to be head of the Abwehr, the German Secret Service. And this was a further boost to the espionage. Now, what kind of booty were they looking for, which is your question? Well, I can mention some of the things they managed to get their hands on. There was an early IBM code-breaking machine. There was, quite famously, the Norden bombsight, which was a gyroscopically stabilized bombsight, which enabled bombers to bomb with greater accuracy. There was the periscope design for new submarines, the hull design of the new generation of destroyers, the aircraft retraction system on the carriers, and the newest design for fighter planes. But one difference, perhaps, between the Soviet and the Nazi efforts was that the Nazis began to collect data on how to attack the United States militarily. For example, they were keen to get hold of the East Coast defense and Panama Canal defense systems.
Well, I'm very interested in how the Nazi spy ring was originally established. Can you describe the main person in charge in the United States, and what sort of person were they looking for to recruit?
Well, as of 1935, the main spy in the United States was a guy called Wilhelm Lankowski, who lived on Long Island, worked in the aircraft industry, and he'd been spying for Germany ever since the early 1920s, when the Abwehr, the Secret Service, was formed. And he looked for people to help him to cooperate with his web of espionage. Typically, these were German-Americans who might have some loyalty to the old country, but in particular, German-Americans who worked in high-technology industry linked to the defense industry. Now, in 1935, Wilhelm Lankowski, whose code name was Sex, incidentally, had a narrow squeak. He was about to board the steamship Europa. Now, the Europa was part of the German-North American line, and the Germans used these fast steamships quite extensively for the purpose of espionage, getting documents back to Germany from the United States. And one evening in the fall of 1935, Lankowski was about to board the Europa, and he was spotted by a customs guard carrying a parcel which was violin-shaped. And it was the immediate suspicion was that there was a submachine gun in it, because that's how you carry your submachine gun in the 1930s. But when he apprehended Lankowski and they opened the package, it was secret documents. Lankowski was told to report back to the police in 3 days, but he took the opportunity to go to a secret location in Yorktown. A former German pilot then drove him at speeds of over 100 miles an hour up to the Canadian border, and he escaped. So that left the German apparatus rudderless, but a man called Gutenberg took over, first of all, and from him, a man called Griebel took over. And by this time, they were directed from Germany by a man called Pfeiffer, who set up a special headquarters in Bremen in Germany, with the object of spying on the United States.
How did the different parties communicate with one another? Through transmitters, through wireless, through pouches of information that were dropped?
Well, they were through pouches of information that were dropped. The Germans had a bad experience in World War I when their Room 40 in the British Admiralty broke their communications code. And famously, the Zimmermann telegram was intercepted, whereby Germany promised Mexico they could retrieve their territories lost in 1846 if only they attacked America from the rear in the case of war. That is one of the events that turned American opinion against Germany and brought America into World War I. So the Germans were very wary of using that more technically advanced means of communication, using the cables, the transatlantic cables. And they used ships in the 1930s until the advent of radio in the early 1940s, when they began to transmit messages using secret codes.
One thing you know is that originally Nazis are reaching out to societies of German Americans, but at some point Hitler changes his mind about Americans because things don't go as expected. Could you describe this change and how did Nazi priorities change in light of the fact that German Americans weren't as receptive as Nazis hoped they would be?
Yes, Hitler at first thought of America not just as technically advanced, but as also being composed of the cream of Europe. People who emigrated to America were from the Nordic parts of Europe by and large. And he thought that these people were the up-and-go, initiative-driven kinds of people who went over in America and founded a great new nation. And he regarded this great new nation as a natural ally to Germany. And of course, this is a very racially traited argument. And so at first, he regarded the Bund, which was the amalgamation of German-American societies in the United States, as a natural ally. And he began to have the Bund penetrated in order to use it as a lever to change American opinion as a whole in favor of Nazi Germany. But there was a reaction against this because 99% of the members of the Bund felt they were a new country and owed their loyalty to the United States. He then tried the tactic of Americanizing the Bund. And for this purpose, he briefly put in charge a man called Ignaz Griebel, was one of the chief villains in my book. Now, Griebel was a German immigrant, a prominent anti-Semite, who made a blacklist of American Jews, such as Mayor LaGuardia of New York, who were to be disposed of once the Nazis took over. Well, Griebel was also, however, a member of, was enrolled in the United States Army as a medical person. He was a gynecologist by training. And in his waiting room in his office in Manhattan, he had a large Stars and Stripes and his certificate stating that he was a member of the American Armed Forces. So he's a much more American kind of guy. So Hitler's followers tried to Americanize the Bund movement. But this also failed because German Americans could see through this. And also, American public opinion and writers such as Ernest Hemingway began to complain of what they called a fifth column, Germany trying to subvert American society in an insidious manner. So the whole idea of the Bund as a lever of Nazi power crumbled. And when that happened, Hitler lost his faith in that project. And at this time, he turned to espionage as the main instrument. Okay, we can't get America on our side, but at least we can steal their secrets.
Hmm. And the spy master in charge at this time, was it Eric Pfeiffer or was it someone else?
Pfeiffer, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So tell me about him and also the German Americans that he recruited for the spy ring.
Well, Eric Pfeiffer was an officer in the German Navy. He'd taken part in the Battle of Jutland on the leading German ship. He was a war hero. He came from a certain segment of German society. He had a scar on his face, which was a dueling star, which meant he was upper class. He got on with people like Canaris, the head of the upper. And in many ways, his loyalty was to the German Navy above his loyalty to the Nazis, but he considered it to be his patriotic duty to go about getting as much information out of the United States as he could. So he, what spies did he use? In part, he inherited the Lankowski network and the Gutenberg network. He worked through Griebel. They found a number of people working in the defense industry who were German Americans and would be prepared to cooperate. Some of them cooperated free of charge, and others were rewarded financially quite handsomely by the Pfeiffer network.
Hmm.
Yeah, but I should have mentioned that by 1938, Hitler had changed his mind on the racial superiority of the United States and now described it as a Jewish scrap heap.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
This is a very fast turn of events, so the ideological flimsiness really shows itself here. And can you also describe, the spy network is successful in learning of different military technology and reporting it back to the Nazis. Could you describe how the spy ring is able to collect it of things like aircraft carrier designs, fighter plane designs, bomb sites, code-breaking computers? How do they gather this intelligence, and how do they transfer it back to Nazi Germany?
The methods varied, but in the case of the IBM code-breaking machine, they simply bought it. They paid some money to the event and bought it. In the case of ship designs, these were smuggled out. The blueprints were copied and smuggled out via the ships, such as the Europa. They used methods such as a man called Ritter, who was one of the German spies, had a special rolled umbrella, which was modified in order to take blueprints. Blueprints were rather large objects. And if you made a proper copy, that was quite large as well. And so he used the, he rolled his umbrella around the blueprints and then took it back on the ship. Ease with which some of the information was obtained is quite alarming. I think that the American defense industry wasn't really geared to high security. And there was a lot of criticism of the way in which they allowed this this information to escape. There was also a school of thought. For example, there was an editorial in the New York Times which argued this case. That the whole idea of espionage was outdated and absurd, because technical information could now be obtained in the learned journals. People weren't guarding their secrets anymore. The new design of American destroyer, the naval ship to destroyer, was being built in Brazil on American plans. So what's the point of arguing that these secrets have to be protected? But that was a naive argument by the New York Times. In fact, 10% of the knowledge was always kept secret if possible. But the procedures in American industry were very poor. And what happened as a result of this espionage episode was that American industry became much more security conscious than it had been.
That's very interesting that some would argue that espionage doesn't matter, especially in the 21st century when many people are concerned about corporate espionage or discussions of China stealing intellectual property and things of that nature. What do you think were the biggest items of intellectual property that Nazi spies stole? What was the biggest win, I suppose, for this espionage ring?
Ah, well, you're asking a technical question here. I think the Norden bombsite has gained a great deal of publicity because people didn't realize at the time, in the 1930s, that it had been stolen. But the information got out in 1941, on the eve of American entry into the Second World War. And it was a real sensation then when it was discovered that had been stolen. But to my mind, the bomb site wasn't perhaps as important as the code-breaking machine. The hull design for the new generation of destroyers that the Nazis got their hands on was actually a bit of a false alarm, because they were experimenting with aluminum hulls or aluminum alloy hulls. And the experiment fell through, so I wouldn't rate that very highly. aircraft retraction systems of the carriers. That is quite important. The newest fighter plane designs, I think that is of considerable importance. And in fact, the people who were designing these fighter plane designs had been trained in Germany and betrayed the details of the designs back to Pfeiffer in Bremen. So I think you'd have to be really a technical expert and a military expert to be able to place these items in order of priority. But perhaps the bomb site has been exaggerated. And in fact, there was a division in German opinion over this. Some Germans claimed that the theft of the bomb site design was hugely important for the Luftwaffe, which copied it. But other German aircraft designers said, that's nonsense. We were already designing a bomb site along these lines, and the American prototype had no influence on what we were using in World War II.
Could you tell me more about the bomb site designs? That's not something that I'm aware of. What were those plans for, and what did the Nazis hope they would gain out of stealing those plans?
Well, bombing accuracy has always been a great goal of the military. It enables you to destroy your target more effectively, and also it reduces the possibility of collateral damage, that is, killing a lot of innocent civilians. So it's much sought after. The idea of a gyroscopic bombsite is a gyroscope is what they use it with a ship's compass when the ship is rocking to and fro and they want the compass to be steady and horizontal. And they thought a plane is bobbing about in the air when it's about to drop its bombs. And if they could somehow stable that with a gyroscopic design, then that would improve the accuracy. And there were two companies in Manhattan working on this bombsite. One is the Sperry company, and the other one was a Norden company, and the company won the contract with the U.S. Navy. It was the Navy's planes which were going to use these bomb sites, and that is the design that the German spies got their hands on. That was the one that was smuggled out of the country in an umbrella by a man called Ritter.
And you said that after the spy ring was discovered, many people believed that the leak of this bombsite intelligence had a major impact in the war?
No, it didn't. The leak itself did not have an impact.
But did some people believe that it did?
No, I think that some people thought, and I'm talking about historians now rather than contemporary actors in the 1940s.
Yes.
Some historians have looked at the revelations about the Norden bombsite in 1941 and have looked at that as a major example of the theft of technology from the military-industrial sites in the United States. The reason it didn't have an impact, I think it would have had a political impact. The reason it didn't have a political impact was that war was imminent. And by the time the later spying, there was a spying in 1941, when that came to light. When the courts passed their sentences, the war had already begun because the Japanese attacked at Pearl Harbor. So the political impact of the bombsite revelation was limited because war was already beginning. Whereas if you look at the episode in 1938, war is still a distant prospect. And that's why the revelations then had a greater impact on opinion. And I think it's important to bear in mind that America had signed up for neutrality between 1935 and 1937, with three neutrality acts passed. The United States was very conscious of having perhaps rushed to conflict in the First World War, and people were looking back at that rather critically and wanted to avoid another war. And that explains, I think, the intellectual background to the New York Times editorial, which said that espionage is ridiculous and secrets shouldn't be kept. It was a kind of utopian view of international relations. And the revelations in 1937 just destroyed that. And people could see that actually the nasty realities of European military rivalries were impacting on the United States.
Absolutely. I want to get into how this ring is uncovered. But before that, in your book, you mention some of the brutal and ruthless methods that members of this ring used to achieve their goals, included murdering the wife and daughter of an American industrialist, which I was very surprised by because that doesn't seem covert at all. So could you describe some of the methods that they used to achieve their goals?
Well, this is an episode that's occurred in San Francisco, which was quite an important center for American espionage, as it had been in the previous war. San Francisco had links to Latin American Nazi spy rings and was an important entrepot. Background to the two murders is that a German-American industrialist had developed means of potentially chemical warfare, and the Germans were keen to get their hands on it. And they decided that the method they would employ would be to kidnap his wife and daughter and to inform him of this and then to use him in order to extort the information from him, because although he was German-American, his main loyalty was to the United States. So they took him to the desert in New Mexico, and their bodies ended up there. It's clear that they were murdered by the Abwehr, by the German Secret Service, or by Nazis who had infiltrated the German Secret Service. This is another problem. And that much is clear, but we can only speculate as to how they met their deaths. The most plausible theory is, I think, that the two women just refused to cooperate, and so they killed them.
Hmm. Was this common, using these types of brutal methods, or was it only when a mission went askew and they weren't able to achieve their means in a covert fashion?
I think that's the example I just gave is an extreme example. Normally, in peacetime, they didn't resort to killing people. Once war began, it was a different matter. But they did. They had in New York City, the Gestapo had a presence, and so they were resorting to methods such as beating people up and making threats and that kind of thuggery. It was just quite a brutal approach, really.
One of the protagonists in your book is Leon Theroux, or Turo. How is it pronounced? I should probably get this right.
I say Theroux because it sounds French, but I think the family would say Theroux.
As my listeners know, any French word that exits my mouth will almost invariably be mispronounced, so that's good to get now. But,
but you're okay because he wasn't French. He was Polish.
Excellent.
Polish Jew.
All right. Well, then everyone is going to get it wrong, so that's great. He is a FBI detective. Could you tell me how he is initially comes onto this case, and how does he discover a Nazi spy network, and what are steps he takes to unravel it?
Well, Leon Theroux, as I just mentioned, was born in Poland. His original name was Turovsky, and he changed his name to Theroux, which he thought sounded a bit more American, when he applied for citizenship in the early 1920s. He was a pretty interesting guy. I mentioned he was Jewish, but he never admitted that. He kept his Jewish identity secret because he was ambitious. And he thought he knew that there was a great deal of anti-Semitism around. And if he pretended that he was a Catholic, which he did for most of his life, then there would be less prejudice against him. And also for a further strategic reason, which was that if you're going to attack Nazi Germany and criticize the anti-Semitic policies which emanated from Nazi Germany, Theroux thought, if he proclaimed that he was a Jew, then people would say, well, you're biased. The reason you're rounding up these spies is because you're biased, you're Jewish. The reason is because you're launching an anti-Nazi campaign, which he did in the aftermath of a case. The reason you're doing that is because you're biased. Now, interestingly, in Hollywood, where a number of the major movie bosses were Jewish, they had exactly the same approach. It was softly, softly on the Jewish identity, because they felt that if they pushed it, they'd be accused of being biased in their criticism of Nazi Germany. Finally, the matter came to a head when Theroux had launched a publicity campaign against the Nazis after he resigned from the FBI at the end of the case. And the the Hollywood moguls, the Warner Studio, brought out a movie based on his exploits called Confessions of a Nazi Spy. So he was secretly anti-Jewish. And from the very beginning, he was vehemently anti-Hitler. Okay, now how he got into the FBI because of J. Edgar Hoover's talent spotting. Whatever you think about J. Edgar Hoover, he had a good eye for a clever agent. And he spotted Leon Theroux early in the 1920s. In 1924, in fact, he tried to recruit him for the FBI. He couldn't succeed to begin with because Theroux didn't have a law degree, which is expected of special agents in the FBI. Because there was a retrenchment and reduction of budgets in the FBI in the 1920s. But in the 1928 election, Theroux made himself indispensable by campaigning for Hoover, the Republican candidate, Herbert Hoover, who became president in the following year. And Hoover was able to recruit him. And he immediately proved to be a brilliant detective. And several people in the FBI made this point in his personnel file. This is the FBI's best detective. And so he was put on to some of the most taxing cases, came out of these well. When the FBI got a tip-off about the spy case early in 1938, Theroux had to find somebody to put in charge of the investigation, and he turned straight away to Leon Theroux.
So tell me about this when he turns to Leon Theroux for the special investigation. So you mentioned that he was a spy. He worked with the FBI. He was eventually dismissed with prejudice. And then yes, he works to set up a press campaign, talking with different figures in Hollywood. And how does this eventually come to a head where he's able to root out this Nazi spy ring?
Well, he was able to root it out because I mentioned the interception of a telegram in January 1938. The plot there was to kidnap an American U.S. Army officer, Colonel Henry Elgin, either using entrapment, one of the women at the disposal of the other, or by sending a forged order from the head of the United States Army, asking Colonel Elgin to turn up at the McAlpin Hotel for a secret mission carrying the East Coast defense details of the United States. That was its content of the telegram. And of course, because of the tip-off, this never came about, and Colonel Elgin was told to ignore the approach. But a couple of weeks later, in the middle of February, a guy called Gunther Rumrich was caught out in a passport scam. The German Secret Service, the Abwehr, wanted to get a number of American passport application forms so that it could obtain fraudulent U.S. passports for its secret agents, which it then proposed to send into Soviet Russia because there was mounting espionage against the Soviet Union. Now, Rumrich was caught out by the authorities. It turned out that his code name was Crown. This had been the code name of the person who'd engaged in the plot, McAlpin Hotel plot, to kidnap Colonel Henry Elgin, who, by the way, would probably have been killed. And that's the reason why the British sent the tip-off. It didn't want an American army officer to be murdered in that way. Another example, of course, of their ruthlessness. So in mid-February, Rumrich is arrested and he's turned over to Theroux. Theroux realizes that he's a member of an extensive spy ring. Rumrich sings extensively to Theroux in exchange for a promise for lenient sentencing. Theroux realizes at this point that Rumrich is a minor cog, but the leads that Rumrich gave him led him to the epicenter of the spying, and especially to Ignaz Griebel. Ignaz Griebel, though a congenital liar, talked a lot to Theroux. He refused to sign a confession, but he talked a lot, and Theroux was able to piece his investigation together. And Theroux had an amazing quality of being able to inspire confidence from the people he was interrogating. I mean, it's a cliche that sometimes people got better results by offering a suspect a cigarette than by beating them into pulp. But Theroux had that methodology down to a fine art. He wasn't a terrible, truthful person himself. He made about all kinds of fairy stories about his own past and about his father, a person who probably never met. And because he was so mendacious himself, perhaps that gave him a slight edge when it came to spotting mendacity into the people at the other side of the table when he was interrogating them.
Interesting. He understood the good cop, bad cop routine before that was a standard trope of interrogation, and suspects could see through it and then clam up. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Is this through his interrogation of Ignaz Griebel? Is this what eventually leads to the downfall of the spy ring?
Yeah, I think Ignaz Griebel was his main informant. It was Griebel who let him know that there was a spy organization based in Berlin that was run also from Bremen. He gave him a number of spies, for example, a guy called Voss. And they gave him the names of a number of spies, and Romlich was able to, and Theroux was able to proceed from there, arresting the people who were nominated, interrogating them, getting more names, and widening the investigation in that way. He was, however, hampered by the fact that someone in the NYPD, leaked the details of the initial arrests. So they were all over the New York press. And of course, in Germany, they found out because of that. And the orders went out to German spies in America to return to Germany as soon as possible, and not to go in, not to board any ships which put in at American ports. So quite a number of the people in the spy ring managed to escape to Germany, and only four people were put on trial at the end.
And speaking of the trial, this was a national sensation, and it played a significant role in shifting public opinion against Germany. Can you tell me about the trial and how exactly it shifted public opinion in the United States?
Well, I think the trial shocked American opinion because of the spectacle of a foreign power interfering on American soil. I think that's extremely important because at the same time, there were atrocities taking place abroad. For example, Kristallnacht, the purging of the Jewish properties in Germany, took place simultaneously with the Nazi spy trial in New York. But because it's an event at home and affected Americans, it had a greater impact. But at the same time as having an impact because people were shocked, the trial made itself known. It was highly publicized because of its entertainment value. And one of those, a prominent feature there, was the story of the attempt to establish a so-called sunnel in Washington, D.C. One might otherwise describe it as the brothel, where American army officers and naval officers and politicians were to be supplied with beautiful young women and wine and good food and so on, with the objective of compromising them so that they could be blackmailed into revealing to Germany not only military secrets, but the planning objectives of the White House as well. So this was an entertaining story that came out in the trial. And it turned out that Griebel, we mentioned him before, he was a married man. He married the nurse who nursed him in Austria after he was wounded in the First World War. But he was an inveterate womanizer. And his mistress, as of 1937-38, was a woman called Kate Moog. Now, Kate Moog had managed to convince everybody that she had nursed Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1920s when he was sick with polio, that is, before he became president of the United States. And he said that when he was She was his nurse. She had made acquaintance of all kinds of members of the American political establishment, including many of those appointed to high office by Roosevelt once he entered the White House. So Griebel decided to take his girlfriend, Kate Moog, to Germany, where they met Eric Pfeiffer, and then proceeded to Berlin, where they stayed in an expensive hotel, and went to meet Admiral Canaris, the head of the Abwehr, to explain the plan they had for setting up the brothel in New York. Now, this is a very entertaining story. They began to compare Kate Moog with Mata Hari, the famous German spy who was shot by the French in 1917.
So you mentioned how it shifted public opinion against Germany and in many ways could have primed the pump for America to quickly support the war effort after the Pearl Harbor bombing. Before we discuss the long-term implications and the importance of the story, I have a hypothetical question for you. Let's say that the spy ring had not been broken up and it had continued to steal military intelligence and designs for aircraft and who knows, possibly even entered the Manhattan Project. How much of an impact do you think the spy ring could have had if it had not broken up? Do you think it would have stolen significant intelligence or would its intelligence always have been marginal and not really affected the outcome of the war all that much?
Well, it did obtain significant intelligence. I mean, its failure was that its agents were detected and then exposed. It, the spy ring, although broken up in 1938, continued and then expanded later. And getting the details of the atomic bombing developed, the Manhattan Project was one of its top priorities. If that had happened, if they had got hold of the bomb before America got hold of the bomb, then conceivably, this might have changed the course of the war. Although I'm not one of those who goes in for fancy theories about intelligence being the key element in a war. For example, it's claimed that British intelligence shortened World War II by 3 years. That's a serious claim, which I think is preposterous, frankly. And I think we have to remember that America came out on top in the war because of the GIs.
Right. That's in big bold letters, the recent film about Alan Turing. At the end credits, it says, due to the work of Ultra, the war was shortened by 2 years. It is stated as unequivocal fact. So, yes, I agree.
Oh, it's come down to 2 years. It's come down to 2 years.
Right. Yeah, that is a very bold claim. And of course, the codebreaker was significant, but there are other factors at war too.
Yeah, it must be remembered that Germany had broken our codes as well.
Right, but that didn't change the fact that they...
It's a two-way process. You know, the Germans are sitting stupidly at home doing nothing.
Right. Just being aware that there are 500,000 aircraft coming toward you when you had not been aware of it beforehand doesn't change the fact that there are hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of aircraft coming toward you. Yeah, so, well, that's a separate discussion. But, well, thank you for this overview. I'd like to wrap up this discussion by your interpretation of what is the long-term significance of this story and understanding Nazi espionage in the United States. Why do you think this story is worth knowing today, and what are the long-term implications of it?
I think that I would like to see Léon Theroux restored to his rightful place as an American hero. You mentioned earlier that he was dismissed with prejudice from the FBI. This was because Hoover took exception to his going public with his story. He sold his story to the New York Post. I mean, I have some sympathy with Hoover here, but Theroux was blacklisted by Hoover for federal employment. And in the end, he emigrated to France just after the end of the war, where he became J. Paul Getty's security guy. And these two factors, blacklisted by Hoover and his emigration to France, I think have removed from the sight of historians someone who is actually an American hero. Secondly, I think perhaps we have an object lesson in the story of the Nazi spy ring, which is that foreign interference in U.S. internal affairs can spark a reaction and an opposite result to that intended.
Well, this is a very fascinating chapter in World War II. And as you mentioned, there are characters here that we know very little about, but perhaps deserve a place in the pantheon of heroes, which we do know more about. Oh, the name of the book is The Nazi Spy Ring in America, Hitler's Agents, the FBI, and the Case That Stirred the Nation. Professor Jeffries Jones, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spy Masters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our illustrious Spy Masters include Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivy, and Wire Meets Wood Guitars at wmwguitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged. to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.